Jesus never sent anyone to do this alone. I don't know why we think everybody does it alone.
Hi, I'm Carl Vaders, and welcome to The Church Lobby, Conversations on Faith and Ministry. My guest in this episode is Peyton Jones, and we'll be talking about the art and science of making disciples. The stats are troubling. In a recent survey, pastors acknowledged that discipleship is the aspect of church ministry that they and their church do the least well. And when church members are surveyed, only 23% of Christians say they were ever discipled one-on-one. Peyton Jones is a church planter and a church planting specialist, and now he's tackling this discipleship crisis head-on. He's written several books, most recently, Discipology, The Art and Science of Making Disciples. In it, Peyton uses the disciple-making pattern from the life of Jesus to describe what he calls the discipology flywheel, where three essential elements come together: time, where disciples are formed, teaching, where disciples are trained, and tactics, where disciples are sent. And don't forget to stick around when the interview is done. I'll come back with my quick take on three dominant church models and how you can move from any one of them into a more balanced, Christ-like approach to disciple-making. Plus, there's one simple note for you in this episode. We had a few slight problems with the audio on my side of the interview, so there are a few times when my voice sounds a little muffled or a little staticky. Don't worry about that. We've cleaned it up as best we can, but some of it remains, so when you hear it, don't adjust your volume. It's not you, it's us, and it goes away quickly. Well, Peyton Jones, welcome back to the Church Lobby.
Hey, Carl. Good to be here.
Actually, I'm saying welcome back, but I don't know if it's a welcome back to the podcast, but it's your first time in the Church Lobby because you were on way back in episode 21, and back then it was called Can This Work in a Small Church?
That's right.
And I changed it for a couple of reasons. One was because the answer was always, yes, it can work in a small church. Why am I interviewing people about things that wouldn't work in a small church? And secondly, we wanted to widen the opportunities for others who may not necessarily be in smaller churches. But the idea is, of course, that the Church Lobby is the place where we get to have all of these really cool, very honest conversations, sometimes challenging ones, sometimes enjoyable ones, and where a whole bunch of pastoral ministry happens. So welcome, I guess, for the first time to the Church Lobby, though the second time to the podcast itself.
Well, thank you. I've always been a fan of your work. My current treasurer, when he first got to know what we were doing with New Breed Church Planting, he said, you know, you need to read this book called The Grasshopper Myth. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of you because we both thought very similarly. And I've been a fan all these years.
Yeah, thanks. And me of you as well. When you were on the first time, we talked about your book, Church Plantology, The Art and Science of Planting Churches. And you stuck with theology now. You've gone from church plantology to discipology. I always want to say discipleology, but it's not. It's discipology, the art and science of making disciples.
That's right.
Yeah, and it released just this week. So we are recording before it releases. I had the chance to read an advanced copy, but this will come out as you're hearing this. The book is now available for you to order. And I really appreciate that you wrote a book that is so thorough. It's a tome. It's a hefty read, but there's so much good stuff in it. Because as I wrote in Desizing the Church, we have not taken the time to emphasize discipleship in the church as we should, despite the fact that it is the thing Jesus told us to do.
Yeah.
And you and I have talked about this in conversations before, including our original conversation back in episode 21. But since you created this term, like I did with desizing, you get to define it. So define it. What is discipology?
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because you make up words when the words that currently exist have either been overused or misused. You know, sometimes, Carl, like that'll make me want to punch people in the face when they say stuff like that. But the reality is we often say discipleship when what we're talking about might be disciple making and vice versa. So what I've kind of done is created a word that takes it back to what Jesus was doing. And of course, the subtitle is The Art and Science of Making Disciples. There was very much a science to what Jesus did. And if you break down discipology, there are three main components three overlapping circles, because we all love Venn diagrams, right? But if you take everything Jesus did in his 3 years in the training of the 12, he either spent time with them, or he instructed or trained them, or he tactically engaged them. So those three are time, teaching, and tactics. And if we were to boil down disciple making, it's really that simple. Spending time with people, teaching them, and tactically engaging them.
Yeah, you do that. It was one of the things that I love so much about the book. You didn't just cherry pick verses. You looked at the rhythms of Jesus' life and ministry, and you used that as the backbone for the structure of your book. And yeah, I wanted to get very much into that structure. But before we do, let's set it up with why a book like this is still necessary 2,000 years into what should have been 2,000 years worth of discipleship. You say this early on in the book, why don't we know how to make disciples in the first place? And you say the first bottleneck to disciple making is simple. Most of us don't know how because it was never done to us. The truth is most Christians have never been personally discipled, and you show it with stats. I mean, how did we get to the point where we're not doing the main thing Jesus told us to do?
Right? And again, I think it goes back to that idea that we think discipleship is disciple making. And both of them are very important, but neither of them is frequently done, often talked about. In fact, it's actually very faddish to talk about. And that's where I was like, okay, same glossary, different dictionary, but we're even mixed up on those two terms. So when we look at this is the discipleship all of us got. And you probably remember this, right? You come to faith and somebody says, hey, welcome to the family of God. And then they put a 1,000-page book in your hand, right? Your Bible, your brand new Bible. They give that to you gratis. And they go, listen, you got to read this. This will keep you strong. And then, hey, you got to pray. Hey, don't worry about prayer. Prayer is the easiest. Just talking to God. Just talk to him like a friend. Oh, and tell other people because you want other people to know what you know now, right? And then, oh yeah, hey, and be sure to come back here next week because there'll be more of the same. And before you go, there's this guy, he's called the devil, hates your guts. He's going to come after you and kick your butt all week. So be sure to come back so we can bandage you back up. All right, see you later. Goodbye. And it's like getting kicked out of an airplane, holding a parachute, not knowing how to use it. That was our 30-second discipleship. And most of us had to figure the rest out on our own.
Yeah. And part of the challenge of it is nothing that you mentioned is incorrect.
Right.
So if it's not incorrect, what's missing in it?
And that's where it comes back to that time, teaching, and tactics. And, you know, in my previous book, Plantology, right? I talk about Paul's learning curve, where he has to go back and start looking back at what Jesus did. Because after his first missionary journey, he did exactly the same thing. He went to the Galatians. He spent a couple months there. And he didn't spend enough time. He didn't give them enough teaching. And then, boom, he came back in the Galatian heresy. It was like that slow, methodical way that Jesus had where he was forming disciples. And this is where discipleship kind of breaks out. Like you mentioned, I studied Jesus's 3 years. And in those 3 years, this is kind of amazing because the time, teaching, and tactics, those three things that make up discipleship. And when I say discipleship, by the way, picture those three circles overlapping. The right. D in the middle is discipleship. And what that really represents is mobilization. How did Jesus make them into disciples who made disciples who made disciples? That's mobilization. Church has been focused on multiplication. I made the same mistake where it's all church planning and multiplication, but we've been multiplying churches that aren't mobilized. They don't know how to make disciples. And so they still stall. They still get stuck. And if you look at what Jesus did, he didn't start in the book of Acts, right? Most of us have done that. Let's just start multiplying churches. Jesus goes back, and this is what I love about your work and where I think a lot of what you and I say overlaps, is it really just becomes about people. And Jesus just slows down and says, hey, we're not building this big thing to scale up. I'm going to pour myself for the next 3 years into the people in front of me, you 12. And in that first year, he really just spends time with people. They travel back and forth to Jerusalem for Passover. He recruits 6, by the way, out of the 12. He doesn't start recruiting the 7th, which is Matthew, till year 2 and then the others after. Yep. He recruits 6. He camps down in Capernaum. And during that year, he's still working with his hands, it seems. He's traveling to the synagogues on weekends. They're going to the festival. They're going to Jerusalem. Eckhart Schnabel, New Testament scholar, works out that they have probably been traveling for almost 3 months of that year, like walking during the daytime hours. But he's spending time with those six. In fact, during that year, his mom tries to get him to do a miracle because obviously he's done a thing or two at home in the past. And she says, "Hey, they need some wine." And he says, "Woman, it is not yet my time." Well, at the beginning of Mark 2, and this is where all of the gospels except for John, they all start in year 2 where Jesus goes on his preaching and healing tour. In year 1, that time, only John spends time on that first year building relationships. So at the beginning of that second year, Jesus says, "The time has come, for I must preach the gospel of the kingdom. This is the reason for which I was sent." So now he's going to go out teaching, and he tours all over Galilee and Judea, and then he heals and casts out demons because not only is he teaching the gospel of the kingdom, he's bringing the kingdom. But all during that year, Carl, the disciples, they just watch. They're spectators. Then in year 3, he moves into the tactical focus where that year, the third year, is bookended by sending the 12 at the beginning. They come back marveling, "Lord, demons listened to us, and diseases were healed, and the sick were cured," because they've never done anything until he drops them in the deep end and sends them out on that mission. And then bookended at the second part of the year is the sending of the 72. And each one of those, again, according to Eckhart Schnabel, New Testament scholar of missiology, New Testament, he says, if you count up the 200, I think it was something like 238 villages in Galilee, six two-man teams, he sends them two by two, would have taken 3 to 4 months. Same when he has 72, but he extends it to Judea as well. Again, 3 to 4 months, at least 4 to 6 months in between. That's when Peter walks on water. That's when he has the disciples feed the 4,000 and 5,000. So he has moved from time to teaching, not stopping time, not stopping teaching, but he's adding a layer on at each stage in his disciple-making process. And I had to study this. I spent 2 years just studying the chronological gospels and looked at the order in which Jesus did everything. And our Bibles weren't written to unpack that for us. And so it was a personal search. I just wanted to know. I make disciples all the time, but I want to know, am I doing this the way Jesus did? Because I make tons of mistakes. And that's part of the art of it. I do think God gives us a lot of, within those three circles, he gives us a lot of wiggle room so that we can express some art along with the science.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say in the book, we tend to make disciples in the same way we ourselves were discipled. And if that's true, then the flip side is also true. We tend not to make disciples how we were not discipled. And so, if that's the case, and I profoundly believe that that's true, then what better way to start with, okay, then let's go right back to the beginning. How did Jesus do discipleship? And how can we duplicate that so that we're being discipled and then doing discipleship and doing disciple making the way Jesus did it?
So good.
The more I spend, as you have, the last few years, especially studying and really re-emphasizing discipleship, the more I've come to an appreciation. I was raised in a pastor's home. My mom and dad are still alive. I still spend time with them every week. But I was raised in a pastor's home. And so I was discipled. As I'm reading all of the processes in this book, I'm going, yeah, I did that. I did that. My dad did that with me because I was raised in a preacher's home where they actually lived in the home what he did from the pulpit. So there was
Yes.
actual discipleship going on in the home. But most people don't go home to a pastor's home.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. And so we have to be more intentional about it because we're not just simply in that environment by virtue of the calling of our parents or whatever. We got to be more purposeful about that. So I want to walk through this because you've talked about it already and given us a bit of an overview. But just to delineate it again for our listeners, Jesus spent 3 years in ministry, and as you outline, in each year of ministry, he had a particular next step in his strategy that he implemented. I don't even know if that's the correct way to say it. Correct it if there's a better way to say it than
No,
I just
that's
did.
good.
Okay, so what I want to do is walk through each of those so that people can clearly understand it, because until you outlined it in the book, I hadn't noticed that shift of year to year. I obviously saw the type of ministry that Jesus had growing. I see as the conflict continues to increase, especially as he gets, you know, closer to Jerusalem and to his final week. But this disciple-making strategy of year by year is something that I hadn't noticed before. So you've already mentioned the terms time, teaching, and tactics. Let's walk through those. Let's start with and look at them one at a time. You say that in his first year, he concentrated on specifically the strategy of time, where disciples are formed. And in the book, you do mention that this is kind of the most, teaching is the most common thing that we get coming right out of the seeker-sensitive movement and out of the megachurch movement. You come to church, you get taught, you go home.
Right.
But that isn't the first step that Jesus had. His first step for that first year was time. So walk us through that to begin with.
Yeah, I think it's so important. And it really, I mean, it moved me. You know, Jesus, he turns around, you know, he sees these two disciples following him and he asks them, what are you seeking? Right. In John 1, it's John and Andrew. They've just heard John the Baptist declare, behold, the Son of God. And when Jesus turns around, what are you seeking? I mean, it's kind of an unfair question because I don't think any of us could answer that if Jesus, when we first trailed along and were interested, but Jesus knew what he was seeking. He wanted a relationship with them. And that's what he does. You know, we tell people all the time, oh, he wants a relationship with you. And what I love about this is, I'll just tell you right now, like, this is being beta tested with a ministry called Through the Word, which I'm one of the teachers on. We had 3,000 people sign up to this. It's just a beta test. Like, it's not even, and right away, the feedback that we're getting is people are saying, oh my gosh, I could do this. I didn't know this was so simple. Jesus doesn't go into a salesman mode at all. And that's always what we're taught, you know, the four spiritual laws or the Romans road, and people are almost ready for some confrontation. And Jesus is just built, have dinner with me, guys. Come and see. Where are you staying is what they blurt out. I don't think they really knew what else to say in answer to his question. And Jesus says, well, come and see. And he just has dinner with them. And then, like I said, like that whole first year, he's just building relationship. One of the things that really stood out to me was that during these times, that the come and see is the first invitation. There are actually three invitations given to these three levels of discipleship. Number one, the come and see in year one, just the invitation to spend time together. So we tell people when they start this is kind of funny because those 3,000 people, the first thing we did to them was we said, hey, go find your number two. In other words, first thing John did is he went and got his brother James. First thing Andrew did was he went and got Peter. First thing Philip did is he went and got Nathaniel. And that first year with those first six, everybody went and got someone else on the journey. And so we say, hey, Jesus never sent anyone to do this alone. I don't know why we think everybody does it alone. Just go grab someone that you think might want to go on this disciple-making journey with you. And you guys will do this together. You're going to spend time together. And then you're going to start praying for somebody. You could be out on the golf course. You could be surfing together. You get, like, whatever you guys do. Do you jam in a band? Like, these are the kinds of things you're going to start. You're going to build relationship, relational equity with people first. So let them get to know you. Be the witness. Don't go into that salesman mode. And Jesus did all that. He just let them start to see who he was and how he operated. He built relationship.
Yeah. One of the things I love kind of getting the wide-eyed, did you really mean that, look back at me when I'm at a conference is when I tell a group of small church pastors, hey, small church pastors, one of the things we're really great at, we are really great at a gloriously inefficient use of our time. You see them looking at me like, did he mean to say inefficient? Yeah, I did. We are really good and we need to get better at a gloriously inefficient use of our time. That is, slow down, Spend time with people. That's why this is called the church lobby, because you're going to spend more time in the church lobby than from the pulpit. That's where you're going to have a greater influence.
Amen.
Sitting with a sick person at a hospital for an entire day is not an efficient use of your pastoral hours, but it's often the best usage of your pastoral hours. Spending time in the community, doing these things, you look back and you've burned so many hours, but you've got to slow down, and relationships just simply take time. I like efficiency. I'm an efficiency wonk. I got so much to do. I love every app that helps me with my efficiency, but I've always got to keep telling myself efficiency is not where the real treasure is when you're talking about ministry. It's going to be in those much slower relational times that burn up inefficient hours, but in the proper way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the guys that has become a really good friend, his name is David Sudke. He actually wrote in one of his books that I read in preparation for this, he's a friend. He actually told me this when we were chatting, but he said that his mentor said to him, "Your temptation is going to spend less time with more people," right? It's all about that Sunday sermon.
Yeah.
He said, and the secret to impact is to spend more time with fewer people. And you look at Jesus, and that's exactly, there's like this funnel, right, of what he did. Because the teaching on a Sunday, like Jesus taught the masses. But if we go back to those three circles, teaching the masses is fine. And I always go back to Rick Warren on this, because Rick had this problem. And you and I have always struggled with when the goal is to have a bunch of people in a room. That's, I mean, my writing, your writing is what it's always had in common. And I think Rick Warren struggled with this early on, and he wondered, how can I get these people discipled? And I know it's not going to happen from the pulpit. And so he started small groups, and he would say that he had double the people in small groups than he had on Sundays. And that to him was the real metric of the church. And so what happens is, on your, say, your Sunday mornings are your teaching circle. Most churches do that. And Jesus did that with the masses. But then when you start getting into the small group thing, that's where we put time over top of teaching. And when that happens, we now have discipleship. But it's not disciple making yet until we get outside the walls of the church with non-believers and we go. See, everything in the Great Commission is go. That's outward. Make disciples of all nations. Right now, now he's on a mission context. These are the people, teaching them to obey. Okay, that's life change. That's, you can see how missional that is. And that's where we're struggling, is the tactical circle. That's what this book is really trying to help people solve. I'm doing the teaching thing. Okay, my church may or may not be doing the time and teaching, right? Because what I say is, information happens when you teach on a Sunday. Transformation happens when you put the time circle over that teaching. But mobilization or activation is what happens when you get people involved in the tactical. And if we can't help people learn to make disciples with the people around them every day, then they're not really getting that experience. They're getting 2/3. 2 out of 3 ain't bad, right? But it's not disciple making yet.
Right.
And that's why we're getting stuck. Discipleship, just for the difference for the listeners, discipleship versus disciple making. And again, I'm the guy that always wants to punch people in the face that want to split hairs on words. It's not about semantics. It really is an important distinction. Discipleship is where you meet with Christians. Disciple making is non-believers. Discipleship, you could go through any topic. And this is good. By the way, this is good. Two circles is good. I'm just saying three circles is gooder. Forgive my bad grammar here.
A strand of three cords. Yep.
That's it. Yep. So discipleship, you're going to be talking any topic. You do Dave Ramsey stuff. You could do, you could go through a book of the Bible. You do anything you want, and you're going to develop somebody in a certain area of their walk with Jesus. Disciple making, you're always making a beeline straight back to Jesus. You want people to know Jesus. That's it, right? You might be meeting with other believers on a Tuesday night. It's within the church. No, this happens with non-believers outside the church. And so on and on, you can kind of see where the difference is. And what we've done is we've kind of swapped these terms, like I was saying earlier. If you've ever gotten a flat tire back in the olden days, right, before we called AAA, we had a donut tire in the trunk. You have to explain this to young people.
Oh,
And on that
yeah.
donut tire, it says, do not exceed 50 miles an hour, nor a distance of 30 miles. In other words, get your butt slowly to a gas station or a tire repair shop quickly, right? Like you don't got time and you can't go fast on this thing. That's like what discipleship is, right? It's good. But what Jesus is talking about in the Great Commission, that needs like rugged all terrain, spinning mud, 4x4 monster tires. That's a Great Commission. If we're driving a car with the donuts on all four wheels, saying, oh yeah, we do discipleship. Jesus said, make disciples. We are. Tuesday nights, we drink coffee and eat coffee cake, and we go through a Bible study together. We're making disciples. Kind of like Iago Montoya said, you keep using that word. I don't think it means what you think it means. It's fantastic that you are doing discipleship. But every pastor, and you and I both know this, every pastor looks over the pulpit and thinks of themselves like a coach. And it felt like, I don't want to be the only one playing here. I don't want to be the team mascot just jumping around here and getting everybody all excited. I want everybody in these pews to put shoulder pads on and put a helmet on and put their mouth guard in and put the charcoal under their eyes and get out and play the game. And that's what Jesus spent those 3 years doing, mobilizing individuals. And I can't tell you, it sounds like I'm like talking about something impossible and hard. And yet the way this is designed, the journal in particular, there's the leader's book and then there's the journal, baby steps every day. Like it's so simple. Just micro steps. And that's how Jesus trained them. He spent 3 years to train them because it's not zero to hero. There's a time element in this. You're going to get there.
And now a short break to talk about something else. If you like the content you're hearing, here are two things you can do for us. First, forward this podcast to a friend. Second, consider becoming a financial supporter through Patreon, Venmo, or PayPal. Just go to carlvaders.com/support. For as little as $3 a month, you can help us put these resources into the hands of the ministries that need them the most. Our support link is in the show notes. Now, in the book, it's in four parts. The first part is raising this challenge and showing us where we currently are. And then parts two, three, and four walk us through the time, teaching, and tactics of Jesus' first, second, and third years. But I did notice there's an order difference. In part one, you mentioned the typical church. We start with the teaching rhythm.
Yeah.
You come to church, you get taught. Then along the way, as the church gets healthier, we realize, hey, we need to add the time rhythm. And then finally, where the tactics rhythm, which we'll get into in detail when we get to Jesus' third year. But Jesus didn't do it in the order of teaching and time and tactics. He did it in the order of time and teaching and tactics.
Yeah.
So is there a way that we in our churches, can we and do we need to reprioritize even chronologically how we approach those three things? Or did Jesus just happen to do it in that order and our order is going to be fine too? Does the order matter, I guess, is the bottom line.
The answer to that, and it's such a good question, Carl, because the answer is no, it actually doesn't. It's a mobilization flywheel. It's actually like if you ever picture like a fidget spinner, those three circles, spin that thing around. You can enter that, any flywheel, you can enter it at any point and get caught up in the momentum. So for example, like we used to in Refuge Long Beach, we would say we were eating together as a community, but we were meeting in the poorest school in the district and the principal asked us to provide another meal for these kids who only ate one meal a day. So we started this and word got out, hey, they're feeding the poor in this neighborhood. So there was this one group of ladies who came and they brought their families. And I think in all, they were about 15 people. They ended up going on the very first ever food truck competition show, but they came and they entered into the flywheel with the tactical component. They joined our tactical mission. They were not saved, But what would happen is we would kick off, they would cook. We gave them a Sunday once a month to cook. And this is all outdoor. We rented the school, but we met in the outdoor cafeteria area because it just helped us reach more people. So, and it was an open air church and it in the hood, that was great. But these ladies heard the teaching and they started spending time with us. Well, of course, you know what happened. They come to Jesus. And now they're caught up in the flywheel. All three of them just became a way of life. At first, it was just tactics, hearing the right. teaching, cleaning up, and taking off.
Got it.
But then they're like, these people are cool. And then they started spending time building relationships with us. And so that's what happened. And it doesn't matter where you enter. I actually point out that the woman at the well, Jesus actually approaches her in a different order. And then she goes to her village, leads them to Jesus in a different order of the same three.
Yeah. So in a lot of churches, it's going to be, okay, here's the one of the three we're doing, or here are the two of the three we're doing. We need to add the third one. It doesn't matter which ones you're doing.
No.
You just want to get to doing all three.
Okay. That's right.
So we've talked about the time Jesus spent that time. And then we, in year two, talk to us about how his strategy shifts and how he then starts going more deeply into teaching. In the second
year.
That's
so good. Yeah, because that second invitation and that second year, right, there's another invitation. And this time, Jesus does the miraculous catch of fish. Peter's like, oh, I didn't catch anything all night. And then he, of course, says, Lord, depart from me. I'm a wicked and sinful man. He's known Jesus for a year already.
Yeah.
But Jesus has already told them, I have to leave. So he's already told him, if you study the chronology, he's already told him he's going to be leaving Capernaum. And they're kind of bummed. Like, they're not thinking they're going with him. And so when Jesus has this miraculous catch of fish in the boat, Peter's overwhelmed with the power and glory of God and says, get away from me, Lord. You know, you're basically, you've got the wrong guy. I make the point that the right guys always say that. But Jesus says, follow me. Instead of get away from me, it's follow me. This is the second invitation now to go deeper into relationship with me. And this, that invitation was follow me and I will make you fishers of men. So he's training them in that second year. He's going to teach them doctrinally through the message of the gospel of the kingdom. And he's going to demonstrate to them, because he says these are signs that validate the message. These are signs of what the Father has said through me. You may not believe my words, but you'll believe the works that the Father does them, and then you'll believe the message. So all of that, that whole year, Jesus models to them everything that they're going to be doing. But he's training them. He says, follow me this second year, and I will make you into something you're not. And that's the beauty of it, is each one of us feels like, hey, you got the wrong guy, Lord. And I'm not a disciple maker. What are you talking about? We're going to leave that to pastors and professionals. And Jesus just takes them out. I mean, I don't know what you think of The Chosen, but I am so impressed when I do watch that show.
Yeah, me too.
With the job that they have done to really flesh it out, because they've really, and by the way, they've studied the chronological Gospels.
Yep. You can tell they have. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems when you first watch it, if you don't know the chrono, you're like, this is out of order. What? No. You know, that time, they nail that time circle in The Chosen. And then when he starts that tour, you just see like they can't keep up with him, right? Yep. He's modeling. They're just spectating and helping and serving as you would a rabbi if you were one of his, what we would call Talmudim. They become the Talmudim or the Talmud, the learners, disciples. And they recognize he's calling them into big boy stuff. That's why they leave their nets at the beginning of year two, standing right there at the beach. When he says, follow me, they follow him, but it says they left their nets. That is now full time. It is a deeper commitment, a deeper invitation, and a deeper response. This was no longer a come and see. This was go all in with me. I will train you and you will become something different.
Yeah. As you're describing it, it's so clear. What if all we're doing is teaching, then all we're doing is disseminating information. But because Jesus had invested time with them, and because his invitation included, and I will make you towards the tactics, one, they trusted him that he was going to take them somewhere. They trusted the destination he was going to take them to. And from the beginning invitation, they knew this is not just a sit down and learn some information process here. This is an invitation to a journey that has a goal.
Yes, absolutely. Well said.
Yeah, all three of those are necessary for that. So the teaching is the part two for Jesus. It's usually part one for a whole lot of our churches. Most of the way we were discipled was through the teaching model. And so we
Yes.
are duplicating what we were given. But then we get to the third part, which is the tactics where disciples are sent. And real quick for our listeners, every one of these three main sections is broken down into patterns, principles, and practices of time, patterns, principles, and practices of teaching, and then patterns, principles, and practices of tactics. So it's very practical. It walks you through all of it. And it's something that you can have and go back to and check on regularly. But talk us through then what happens then in Jesus' third year with the tactics part where disciples are sent.
Yeah, and funny that you mentioned that because the patterns, principles, and practices are just another way of saying time, teaching, and tactics. But because it's broken into those three sections, I knew I'm going to confuse them if I say the time principles of time. So I was like, the patterns, what did Jesus live during that year when he spent time with them? What did he model? And then what were the principles? And then lastly, what are the practices that we can, that not only they glean, but we can glean? And so this is really meant to be a deep dive. Like if you're a leader, this is really important for you to grab the hardcover, the 400 page. It was a labor of love. It's probably my life's work, I suppose, my seminal work. But really, the reason that's important is when recently there was a scholar who did the most comprehensive survey on movements, last name of Prinz. And he came up with 21 common things that all movements share with one another. But the top one is there's always a catalyst, aka Jesus, Paul, John Wesley. You know, you can go through church history and find there's always a catalyst. This is your catalyst book because the movement comes from your people. And I say that movement, not like world movements that are happening in the, I mean, a localized movement. But the idea is that the journal is for everyday disciple makers because they're not going to want to read for, they're going to want in 28 days to go through some training and take baby steps and grab their two and start praying for their who. And, but in the third year, there's a third invitation. And this is where it says, out of his disciples, Jesus gathered 12, calling them apostles. And so he designates in the very, this is actually at the end of the second year, but right before the beginning of the third year, he calls them sent ones. And then of course, when year three kicks off with the sending of the 12 is the very first thing. And at the end, it's bookmarked by he sends them again with more. And you ask, well, where did the rest of those come from? Most likely from that first missionary journey. And so they're already beginning to reproduce and recruit and do what Jesus did. And then the Great Commission, this is all set up to prep them so he can leave. He gets them tactically engaging, making mistakes. Lord, we couldn't cast this one out. That needed to happen at the base of the Mount of Transfiguration. They had to keep failing. Peter had to fail at walking on the water. This trial and error while Jesus is still there so he can coach them. And then at the very end, before he ascends to heaven, after his resurrection, he says, go make disciples. Everything I just did in 3 years, go do that with others. I mean, it is so clearly laid out when you study it chronologically. And it's once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then even in the third year, you lay out, and we won't spend the time to do it today, a three-part pattern that Jesus did in the first 3 to 4 months, and in the middle 4 to 6 months, and then the final 3 to 4 months. Because as we all know, anybody who's spent any time in the Gospels knows that the later it gets into Jesus' life, the more time the Gospels spend on it until, you know, in the book of John, almost half of the book of John is his last week. So even in that last month, that year, there is even more fully defined what those tactics look like. And I do encourage you, as you mentioned, for people to get the physical book. I'm a fan of Kindle. I travel so much. I read a lot of books on Kindle. You sent me the early copy of it as an ebook, but I started reading it and very quickly realized, no, I got to print this sucker up. So I've got this big old binder clip thing here, because it was the only way to really read the way the book it's intended to be read. And that's even because I got the advanced copy. I don't even have a lot of the illustrations in here. But it's still It needs that kind of thing. So I really encourage people to do that. But before we get to the lightning round, because there's so many things we could go with this, I think that gives people a great overview and a great understanding of what the book is all about. In the book, you talk just a little short section to something you call the Shalom Star, which is six aspects of our lives to help us find balance as we allow God to permeate them. And so we're going to talk about that in the bonus content. So if anybody is interested in getting this bonus content on the Shalom Star and how to use the acronym Shalom for the six aspects of your life that find balance only as we allow God to permeate them, you can get that in one of two ways. You can become a financial supporter by going to carlvaders.com/support. And if you become a financial partner, you will get all of my books for free. You will get other things as we produce them, and you will get the free weekly newsletter. If all you want is the weekly newsletter with the links in it, you can get that as well. Just go to carlvaders.com/subscribe. Either way, you will get all of the bonus content, including the bonus content that Peyton and I will be talking about for a little bit about the Shalom Star and the kind of health that that can bring and balance that that can bring into your life with it. It was a great little teaching that I thought people would really benefit by. But before we let you go from this, let's get to the lightning round. You've already gone through it once, but it's been several years, and you and I and everybody who listened forgot it. So you can probably even repeat your stuff and you'll be okay, unless you got new stuff, and we'll take that too.
Probably so, do. My wife, who's been married to me for almost 30 years, when she's asked, what's it been like being married? She says, like being married to three different people. So who knows?
Okay. Who knows what it could be? All righty. Well, then maybe what we'll have to do is put up a before and after and see if you've got any conflicts. We'll see how that goes. All right. Question number one, what are the biggest changes you've seen in your field of ministry in the last few years, and how have you adapted to them?
Yeah, the biggest thing that I've seen, Carl, and I think it's thanks to people like yourself, is that idea that it's not about numbers. And also that it's not about the individual leader, but it's also about team. I think there's been a more holistic, healthy return to a first century understanding and valuing of people. That's what I think that comes down to.
Yeah, I agree. Even mid-size and smaller churches like ours are doing things like a teaching team and so on, so that there's less concentration on I'm coming for that particular preacher. I first noticed it in worship teams, where instead of having an individual leader, the songs would change leaders throughout the service so that your concentration was no longer the people on the stage as much as it was just simply enter into worship. And then it's even happened in preaching. As I say, even in smaller churches, some of that's happening. I believe it is very healthy. Second question, what free or cheap resource like an app or a website has helped you lately that you would recommend for small church ministry?
Oh man, ChatGPT. I mean, that has just been... And not for writing. Like, I'll just tell you right now, ChatGPT, if I ask it, hey, can you help me with this grammar? Like, the book was not written with ChatGPT. It can't write like me. It just can't. I mean, I would be embarrassed to put what ChatGPT thinks I sound like. But holy cow, for research. I mean, I used to use all these Bible tools, you know, like things that I would have to pay money for. And ChatGPT is... I believe, and forgive me for this, Bible programs out there. I know you'll never sponsor me now, but but I'll tell you, ChatGPT is better than any Bible program I've ever owned.
Yeah, we've done several episodes on the benefits and dangers of AI and ChatGPT and so on. So I'll just, for those who maybe haven't heard it before, I do agree with you. Using it to generate content is a bad idea. It never comes across well, but using it for research is really helpful, and sometimes to even just inspire you to think of some new ideas and some new ways that you could express it. I just did it. Here's a fail that I did recently. When I write an article, I then take that article and I put it into a 10-tweet stream. It's now not tweets, it's X, but we still use the term tweet. So it's 10-tweet stream. So I put it in and make it a stream. So I thought last week, I'm going to put that in ChatGPT. My article that I wrote without any AI, can you just reduce this to 10 tweets so I can put it out? And I read back my own content through ChatGPT, and it was horrible. How did you take, I guess at a fundamental level, the thing was kind of there, but it took all the life out of it. It took all of the soul out of it, all the expressiveness out of it. And I realized, like, it can't even condense my words into something that I want to put out there, let alone create them from scratch.
Right.
For research, Research, I'll take it every day. All kinds of great stuff from that.
You know, like the deep work that we've been talking about and scholars like Eckhart Schnabel, it will never do that. Like it
Oh,
doesn't
no,
have
can't.
the capacity. Like that's the thing to me that you're still always going to need a human being. Like it can retrieve information fast for you and collate it, but it can't do this kind of synthesis in the same way. And I know there are people who challenge me, but I have yet to see it.
And it never can, because the best it can do is grab and consolidate information that's already out there.
Yes.
But human beings, because we're made in the image of our creator, have this amazing capacity to create something new or to look at something old
Yes.
in a new way. You can't duplicate that somewhere else because they don't have the soul of the creator within them. So, yeah,
Right.
as long as we're using it the right way, I'm beginning to use it and beginning to get some benefits. But so far, I'm running into more times where it's like, man, I can't even do
Yeah,
that.
absolutely.
But I remember when I was first introduced to my first personal computer, the computer expert, I was living in Silicon Valley. So, like, these guys knew what they were doing. He said, you got to start with this understanding. Computers are stupid. I was like, this is a computer expert. That's what he makes his living on. He goes, they will only do what you tell them and only exactly what you tell them. And if
Yes.
you don't tell them exactly it, like, they can't interpret like a human being can, and they never will. And I've lived
Yes.
with that ever since. If you
So
understand as
good.
much as it can do, computers are stupid.
Yes.
So don't expect anything other than that from them. All right, let's go to number three. We could go on that way too long. Number three, what's the best piece of ministry advice you've ever received?
Ooh, I would say it was said to me early on when I was just starting to serve the Lord. The youth pastor who stepped aside and opened the door for me told me as I was coming through it, remember in the work of the Lord, never forget the Lord of the work. That to me has always been. And then I don't know if it's cheating for me to add something, but something that I've
No, go ahead.
learned that I say to everybody else, and it doesn't matter if it's church planters I'm training or interns or it's always, congregations I lead. It is God cares more for you than anything you can ever do for him. And I think I bend over backwards to make sure people understand that.
Hugely important. Wonderful. And then the final one, what's the funniest or weirdest thing you've ever seen in church?
Oh gosh, I don't know if I can talk about some of them, but
That's a fairly common response.
oh gosh, probably one that I did years ago. And I don't even know if you can play this in today's political climb, but I was doing a wedding. It was in Huntington Beach of all places, and it was a good friend of mine, and I was doing his wedding, and I was waxing poetic, so to speak. And I remember saying, you see, when two men love each other, I don't know why I said men. And I paused in midair. You could feel the tension in the room. Like everybody's looking at the bride, wondering if I knew something no one else did. And I just did one of those, oh, and then the whole room just broke. Everybody's laughing. And I just looked at both of them and said, I'm so sorry. So, you can get away with murder in a wedding. Whatever mistake happens in a wedding, okay, that one's close to almost can't get that one back. But with weddings, that whatever mistake it makes and people laugh, it eases the tension, makes it funner. Funerals, no. Not much room for error, margin for error there. So make sure you always make your faux pas in a wedding.
If anybody wants to reach out to you, including angry emails about that, where can they find you online, Peyton?
Yeah, you can find me on social media. You can Peyton Jones. You can also go to discipology.com. You can write in where there's free downloads, giveaways, resources. How do I use this in my church? There's videos. So you can go to all those places, catch up with me, and write your complaint letter there. Carl Vaders at discipology.com.
The book again is Discipology, the Art and Science of Making Disciples. We're going to stick around for the bonus material. You can go and get that on our YouTube channel. We'll put links to how to do that in the show notes. But thank you, Peyton, so much for your time today. And thank you for the book. I really have appreciated it. And I know it's going to benefit a lot of pastors and churches.
Thank you, brother. It was a pleasure.
Well, since reading Peyton's book and since interviewing him for this podcast, I've been thinking a lot about the time teaching tactics flywheel that Peyton outlines, and I've noticed how it corresponds to three different styles of churches. Go with me on this. First, there's the teaching church. That's my default, where there's an emphasis on theology and Bible teaching. Second, you may be a part of a time church where the main emphasis is on spending time in fellowship, relationships, and gathering together. Or maybe you're in a third type of church, which is the tactics church, where the emphasis is often working towards societal change, sometimes through political means. Wherever your church is, as Peyton mentioned, you can enter the discipology flywheel and add more of the other two elements to have a more balanced approach. Now, please hear me out on this. None of the approaches I've just described is wrong on their own. But one way to tell if you've perhaps become too heavily invested in only one of those circles is that you're more likely to see the negatives in one or more of the other circles than the positives. Here are a couple examples. Perhaps you're a Bible teaching church, but you're really cautious about any church that emphasizes community-based programs. Or maybe you're a lovingly relational church, and you can only think of Bible-heavy churches as legalistic. Or perhaps you're a church that's active in the community, but you're suspicious of any church that only seems to take care of their own. Sometimes the things we're suspicious about in others have a basis of truth. After all, there are churches that are too legalistic, others that are too political, and some that are too insular. But many times what we dislike about others can say more about us than about them. So take a moment to think this through, because if your distrust of any of those circles, even against the obvious extremes that they can become, if any of those elements of distrust is keeping you from taking a more healthy, balanced approach, you're actually being more affected by the church you dislike than by the example of Jesus that we all should follow. This episode was produced by Veronica Beaver. It was edited by Phil Vaders. Original theme music was written and performed by Jack Wilkins of jackwilkinsmusic.com. The graphic design is by Solomon Joy. And me, I'm Carl Vaders, and I hope to talk with you again in the church lobby.